I have a case for you today that is solved. It is from Markham, Ontario. And well, let me just tell you that the boyfriend didn't do it, but he acts super suspicious. So I think there's a lesson in today's story on how not to act when someone you know goes missing. This is the murder of Alicia Ross.
Have a very high tolerance for murder.
He is beyond saving. And I lost a piece of my heart that I'll never be able to get back.
May God bless your dark, broken soul.
Alicia, with her big blue eyes, was born on February 8, 1980 in Markham, Ontario, to her mom Sharon and dad Marvin. And Sharon and Marvin divorced, and then Sharon married Julius Fortas, giving her a stepsister named Randy, and then Marvin married Anna Ross. However, Marvin passed away sometime before 2005. And the Ross family were of Jewish faith. They were a rather large family, so she had siblings Jamie, Andrew, Tammy, Trisha, Randy, Sean, Adam, and Stefan. Now, I'm going on the assumption that Randy is a she, her, based on the spelling with an I at the end, but it could be wrong on that. My apologies if I am. Alicia was an adventurer. She loved to travel, anything outdoors, especially canoeing. She spent a year in Australia after she'd finished her graduate studies. She had an amazing smile that took over her whole face when she used it, which was often. Despite her Jewish faith, she had a couple of small tattoos, including a daisy and her Aquarius birth sign. She also looked a lot younger than her 25 years. And after returning from Australia, she moved back home with her mom and two lovely French poodles to Thornhill, Ontario, where Green Lane and Bronte Road intersect. Thornhill is west of Markham. It's north of Toronto and east of Etobicoke, just for some perspective on that. It's home to about 113,000 residents, and it's most famous for their COVID period coyote problem, where for some reason the coyotes in the area started getting extra aggressive during that time. It was once home to actor Corey Haim and the Philosopher Kings. And on August 17th, 2005, which I cannot believe was almost 20 years ago now, was a Wednesday. Alicia had an interview the next day, so she went for a walk with the dogs and her mom and then reviewed some of the notes that she had for her meeting the next day. And afterwards, her mom, Sharon, ran some errands. She came home. And later towards the evening, it was either Sharon who came to Alicia or Alicia that went to Sharon asking to borrow a purse. Alicia had a date with her new boyfriend, Sean. I'm not going to say his last name because, well, you're going to see why later. They'd only been dating for about a month or so. She wanted to look nice. So I'm going to go on the assumption that it was Alicia asking her mom for a purse to borrow. So Alicia, although she was technically living at home with her parents, she had her own separate entrance to her suite, which was in the basement. So Sean and her went out to play some pool. They came back to her place. They burned some CDs, which was a thing that we used to do. Well, most of us probably made mixed tapes, but I'm sure we all dabbled a little bit in burning some CDs. If you're younger, just sort of picture downloading something from iTunes, but it's a lot more labor intensive. Anyways, Sean left around 11 or 12. She walked him to the end of the driveway, and then she walked back towards her place. The next day, Sharon and Marvin went golfing, and when they left that morning, Alicia's car was still in its usual place in the driveway. But Sean called, and he said that he couldn't get a hold of her. He'd tried her work. She hadn't shown up. At the time, Alicia was working with Hewlett-Packard, and he was panicking. Now, I'm just going to let you know that Sean, again, for whatever reasons, he starts to look and act really suspicious. I mean, he looks as suspicious as a wolf in a hen house, but he didn't kill her. And like, I'm sorry for that spoiler alert, but he didn't do it. And maybe it's just me that thinks that he's acting super suspect, I'm just going to try and play you this little bit of a, it was a short, tiny little clip of an interview.
What's happening is we haven't found Alicia, and that's our main goal right now, okay? I'm so emotional right now, like, this is breaking my, it's breaking my heart.
Tell me about the last time you saw her, what it was like,
because you. I loved her.
So, first of all, like, why is he panicking after not being able to get a hold of her for, like, a couple of hours? And actually, in a later interview, he said that he had called her right when he got home that night and she didn't answer. And that's when he started to worry. So if not suspicious, I think that for you single ladies out there, to me, that's a major red flag. Like, I know this guy isn't a murderer. I want to be very, very clear on that. But I think he's probably pretty controlling when it comes to relationships. I mean, it has been like a month. And when he says he starts to worry, like, my jaded brain just says, like, I think he was more suspicious of what she was doing and who maybe he thought that she was doing it with than he was that she wasn't, couldn't get a hold of. And he says that he really loved her. And again, it's only been about a month. And secondly, why is he using past tense in that? He just gives me a bad vibe. But again, I just want to be very clear that he is not a murderer. I think it's just a lesson for the kids out there. Don't talk about somebody in past tense if you don't know for sure that they're dead. I think there's just red flags with this guy, and I realize I don't know this guy. He didn't kill anyone. I really shouldn't offer my opinion on him based on a couple of interviews and some statements, but I am. The other weird thing about Sean is that he called in the missing persons report and then called her mom. Like, again, I realize that often time is of the essence with these kinds of cases, with especially with reporting someone missing, is like, you want to do it as fast as possible. That's a good thing. And kind of surprisingly that the police took it seriously right away. So maybe if you come across as suspicious, then they take a missing persons report more seriously.
Get 15% off a set of BrakeMess Select, Select Pro, or Import Direct brake pads and two rotors now at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Anyways, whether it was because Sean looked suspicious or because Alicia was young, pretty, and Caucasian, they did take it seriously and searched her place for clues. They found that her purse and keys were still there and nothing was touched from those. Even her shoes were there, making her disappearance appear that it was not a pre-planned event for her. York Police Constable Lori Perk said, normally when you leave the house as a woman, you would take a purse or car keys or a wallet or something, and all of that has been left behind. There was also a cigarette butt, glasses, and a wine bottle kind of strewn around the backyard that definitely didn't look right to her mom. And inside the apartment, the folding process of her laundry had been started, but appeared to have been abandoned mid-folding. A helicopter and canine unit was used in the search, as well as hundreds of volunteers looking for Alicia, who had vanished sometime between 12 o'clock midnight when Sean left and around 9 a.m. the morning when Sharon and Marvin had left for their golf game. And the police searched Sean's house and car and interviewed him at length, and he was ruled out at one point as a suspect. And I want to be clear about that the police no longered him a suspect at all. He was just a witness. But I'm just saying he didn't do himself any favors at all with his behavior and choice of words at the beginning of the investigation. My focus is really more on how his behavior is a red flag. Like, he might be a lovely guy, but he acted in this case like an abuser. So if he's wondering why the police looked at him, it wasn't just that he was the last person to see Alicia. It was because he came across looking like a guy that needed to know every second where his girlfriend was. And that's just not cool. And the fact that he reported her missing to the police even before talking to her parents. Like, she could have just decided to go golfing with him. He didn't know that or that, but he's calling her work looking for her. It's just strange. So the York police held a press conference after finding no trace of Alicia for 4 days. Sharon prayed publicly for her return and made her a promise that she would be coming home soon to them. At that point, Sharon believed that someone had kidnapped her daughter and was holding her someplace and that she was alive. She said, Alicia, I have never broken a promise to you, and I promise you, you will come home soon. She added that anyone that might have information, I beg you to come forward. I wish no harm to anyone, just the safe return of my daughter. By day six, the police issued a statement. Although there is no evidence to suggest foul play and the lack of evidence, we are concentrating on the possibility that foul play may exist and be responsible for her disappearance. Randy, who's Alicia's stepsister, wasn't ready to face that yet, and she said, we love her and we'll be seeing her soon, and she's a strong, bright, intelligent woman, and she's going to be coming home. She'll be home soon. Oh, and then Sean was arrested for drunk driving, and he got a 90-day license suspension, furthering my feeling that he's not exactly boyfriend material. By August 25th, the police, who considered Sean the person of interest du jour, talked to some of his neighbors asking if they had seen anything suspicious, and they searched his family cabin out in Halliburton. And despite Alicia's story being featured as a murder on America's Most Wanted, Sharon remained still hopeful that Alicia was still alive. My message is, I love you with all my heart. I would give my life just to have her come home. I'm not even looking for punishment, you know. I don't wish to harm anyone, just her return. That's all I want. And by mid-September, the search had all but kind of stopped, and the media had moved on to other more fresh stories, and still no Alicia or even any useful tips. On September 20th, so just over a month after Alicia had disappeared, a man that had been interviewed early on in the investigation walked back into the 1st District York Regional Police Station with his lawyer in tow and asked to speak to detectives because he had some information regarding Alicia. 31-year-old Daniel Sylvester, one of the Ross's neighbors, who was admittedly a night owl and slept all day and was up all night, who initially said that he hadn't seen Alicia nor ever really spoken to her between August 16th and the 17th when she disappeared. He says that he actually did see her that night now, and the information that he gave the police ended any suspicion that Sean had been under. Now, I said that he walked back into the police station suggesting that he had maybe been there before. Well, he had. When interviewed, he had said that he had stayed in all that night and he didn't see anything. This time, he started the conversation a little bit differently, saying, I'm responsible for her disappearance. I'm responsible for her death. Basically, I killed her. She died in my hands. Well, that's a little bit different than not seeing her, talking to her. In fact, his initial interview had been that he'd asked if he would take a polygraph, and he said that he would. He just needed to check with a lawyer first, and like any lawyer would, told him don't do it. But other than the fact that he was like a loner, lived with his mom, spent a lot of time either on his computer or working out in his home gym and suffering from anxiety and depression, and that he usually stayed up all night, slept during the day, borrowed his mom's car to go for drives in the middle of the night, there was really nothing that the police could really tie him to any crime. And to be fair, like, I suffer from anxiety and I'm considered a bit of a loner. I've never killed anyone. So over a series of interviews, Daniel laid out how he accidentally killed Alicia that fateful night. So that night around 1:30 in the morning, he was standing in the pathway between the him and the Ross's house. Now, can I just add that he's not just telling the police this stuff. He's actually kind of like acting it out as like a demonstration. I wish I had the video of the interview tapes, but I don't, unfortunately. So after a normal day for him of sleeping, eating, and wasting his time, which is his words, not mine, and then watching TV, he went outside for a walk, which was a thing that he did. Now, this is at 1:30 in the morning. It was a usual part of his waking hours. And there he encountered Alicia, who apparently said something like, what the fuck are you doing? And he said, I have just as much right to be here as you do, to which she said something to the effect of, you're a fucking loser. And he slapped her across the face saying, quote, I was angry and humiliated. I took offense, wanted to confront her. I knew I crossed the boundary when I hit her. It was no longer verbal. It was physical. It was real. So rather than end it there, as anyone normal would have probably several sentences ago, he drove his knee repeatedly. Repeatedly is the word that warrants, well, repeating. into her upper chest while she tried to struggle him off of her, and then managed to get her to the ground and then bashed her head several times on the hard concrete ground. She clawed at his hair and managed to kick him in the ribs. So, quote, "I need her in the solar plexus," and then, of course, gave the police a little demonstration of that. "I knew she was fighting back. I knew she couldn't stop. I knew I couldn't reason with her. I knew I couldn't apologize. I had gone past the point of no return." So he released her at that point, realizing that Alicia was no longer breathing. Quote, "She looked dead. She wasn't breathing. She stopped struggling. She just lay there. I panicked. I didn't know what to do. I knew I was in serious trouble. I knew I caused her serious bodily harm. I was scared." So he left her there for about 10 minutes, just trying to think. She was at that point too heavy to move, and in his words, felt like a water bag. So he grabbed onto the sleeves of her t-shirt and dragged her down the pathway to the side entrance of his mom's garage, which is about 30 meters away, so not that heavy, apparently. He left her in the garage for about 45 minutes while he used the garden hose to wash the grass, the fence, the pool heater, the front steps of Alicia's blood, went inside, took a shower, gathered up her bloody clothing and the towels that he used to clean up the blood from the garage floor into garbage bags, which he put into the trunk of his mom's Ford Mustang after lining the trunk with some cardboard, just not to be all messy, and put her body in the trunk, wrapped duct tape around her hands so that they didn't, quote, flail around. Again, his words, not mine. And wrapped her head with a rag as it was still actively bleeding, which to me indicates that she was still alive at that point. Then he drove her out to the area of Manila, which is not in the Philippines. It's in the town of Ontario. It's just northeast of Newmarket. On the way home, he dumped the garage bags with the clothes and towels just south of the town. And in a moment of, like, are you serious? Telling the police he came forward because he wanted to make it right. I mean, it was just an accident after all. Quote, "I didn't understand how nobody could have seen me do this." So Daniel led the police to two areas northeast of Toronto where her remains and the clothes had been thrown. But here's the thing. It wasn't out by Manila where he originally says that he dumped her. No, he went back 3 weeks later and moved her out to a dump site close to his parents' cottage, which is in Cobequid. So that was a thing. Now, there were a couple of reports that say that her body was found dismembered. However, the medical examiner testified that her severe injuries resembled a car crash victim's and she had suffered 32 broken bones. I think that sometimes journalists will report on battered and like broken bodies as being dismembered. It just somehow makes the story like more gruesome or like sexy or whatever, if I can use that word. So I can't confirm that was how she was found. There's nothing in his confession that would suggest that, but I haven't read the autopsy report, so I'm not 100% sure on that. But she did have enough blunt force traumas to cause a substantial loss of blood. And the same reports that use the term dismembered say that he mutilated her body after her death to contain it from any further movement. But I think that might actually be referring to the duct tape that was around her hands. Anyways, it doesn't matter. In the end, she suffered a brutal death. I just like to get my facts straight on that. Daniel had lived next door to the Rosses for about 7 years. He knew the Rosses kind of, like mostly just her brother, one of her brothers, but thought Alicia's name was actually Trisha. He was a high school dropout, unemployed, and I'll say it, a loser. On October 7th, 2005, a funeral was held for Alicia at the Beth Emeth Synagogue in North York. And according to the Jewish tradition, she should have been buried within 24 hours of her death. But Daniel decided to deny her family that right, and more than 500 people attended the funeral. The Toronto Sun issued an apology to Sean, who had included his last name in their articles. They blamed it all on a presumptuous public. And I'm glad that they did that because, again, he's not a murderer. He actually moved to Florida just to avoid all the crap that comes with basically being suspected of something heinous that you didn't do. And I know I haven't really said much nice about Sean, but I've always been clear that just because I don't think that he had the makings or at least was waving some red flags around about his long-term successful relationships, it doesn't make him a killer of women. So during the trial, some stuff came out that that Daniel hadn't told the whole truth and nothing but the truth about how things went down that night, including that he had been a peeping Tom in his neighborhood for quite some time, pointing to a motivation that was a little bit more sexual in nature than just being called a loser, which is not actually slander. I think that it was a factual statement from Alicia that she did in fact say that. It was also revealed that he wasn't exactly the sharpest knife in the drawer. The fact that he'd left his wallet in a pair of shorts that were stained with blood and he had dumped in a wooded area meant that his request to have it pleaded down to manslaughter was denied. So he pled not guilty to second-degree murder. And the prosecutor, Kelly Wright, stated, he told police he encountered her and they exchanged words. He slapped her on the face, he pushed her to the ground, and drove his knee into her solar plexus several times. He took her head and banged it into the ground several times. Mr. Sylvester lined the inside of his truck and put the body of Miss Ross inside. He cleaned up the blood, had a shower, and drove about 80 kilometers northeast of his home to a wooded area near the town of Manila. Some of the remains were transferred 3 weeks later by Mr. Sylvester to the Cobequank location. The courtroom testimony saw Sylvester describing himself as a fringe individual who did not do well with other people. According to testimony, Sylvester advanced upon Ross shortly after her boyfriend had left. He said that during the argument with Ross, she called him a name which made him snap. She insulted me and called me a loser, and that's what really got me going. He said on the video, asked by McVitie if he'd ever been called that name before, and he responded, yes, many times throughout high school and even grade school. I just have social difficulties with other kids. I have anxiety problems. McVitie asked him to pen a letter to Ross and her family. I don't know what I'd say. He told the detectives he started sobbing uncontrollably. I would say I had no right to take your daughter's life, he cried, turning away from the detective and facing a wall. Through his tears, he wrote a two-sentence note to the Ross's family. I am beyond words. I cannot possibly express how sorry I am for what I have done. McVitie left the interview room, but the tape was still rolling. Sylvester could barely be heard talking to himself. I should never have been born. Earlier in the tape, Sylvester said he regretted the grief that he'd caused his mother. I told her that I'd never do this to hurt you. I'd never put you in this position. All the shame and humiliation you're going to have to bear being associated with me, you know that she doesn't need that. She's 71. And after about 3.5 hours of wading through all the evidence, on May 29, 2007, the jury of 8 women and 4 men came back with a guilty verdict. With a life sentence, he's not eligible for parole for 16 years, which was actually in 2021. I couldn't find any reports that he actually made an application for parole then, but there had been a petition signed at that time stating, Sylvester is eligible for parole before his life sentence in September of next year if he wishes to apply and may potentially be granted an early release. The intent of this petition was created to advocate on behalf of the victims of homicide and the families and loved ones who endure a hurt so substantial that the suffering of these devastating losses could never be undone. It is our hope that enough awareness may be influential to the Parole Board of Canada and deny the early release of Sylvester into the community and thereby ensuring the safety of the public. So as far as I know, he's still living in jail somewhere, but probably a minimum security with like tennis courts and a golf course. The Ross family started the Alicia Ross Memorial Fund for Youth and donated the majority of the funds to Project Canoe. Alicia had taken that summer trip in 1988 to Georgian Bay, and she loved canoeing. Project Canoe, which can be found at canoe.org, says on their website, we partner with youth facing barriers to create experiences rooted in the outdoors. Our programs foster learning, confidence, and transformation. We recognize that there are significant obstacles to the outdoors for youth with barriers and those who want to work in it. We are therefore dedicated to integrating anti-oppressive and equitable processes throughout all facets of the organization to ensure we are meeting the diverse needs of our youth and broader PC community. We understand that by seeing each youth as a unique individual, the opportunities for growth and change are endless. We prioritize learning from our youth and working alongside them in our governance, program planning and implementation, evaluation and communications. We are committed to creating environments that are welcoming, participatory, and trauma-informed. by providing a high level of support and care. We place the health and well-being of our community above all else. Kindness and respect are central to all of our relationships. This also extends to the environment and how stewardship of the land is integrated. We believe that the inherent healing power of the outdoors is key to our programs. We use this venue to assist youth with self-examination while celebrating successes and creating countless memories. And again, you can find more information about them at canoe.org. And that was the really sad murder of Alicia Ross. And I'm going to be back again next week with another sad case. In the meantime, please consider signing up for the exclusive feed. It is ad-free. There are bonus episodes that I think are worth a listen there. You can sign up for a week or a month or whatever you want to do. You can download it. You can listen to some stuff. And then you can cancel anytime. And the link is below in the show notes. Most importantly, please continue to recommend the podcast to anyone that you discuss true crime with, which is probably anyone that's going to listen if you are anything like me, and that has really helped me grow the show. And as always, thank you so much for listening.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.